Good morning. This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. Thanks for joining us. In the studio today, I'm joined by Russ Baker, award-winning investigative journalist and author. Baker has written for The New York Times, The Washington Post, The LA Times, The Nation, The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, the list goes on. He's the author of Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and The Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. He's also the founder and editor-in-chief of the online news source whowhatwhy.com. Good morning, Russ. Thanks for joining us today.
Good morning. Great to be here.
I think, you know, as I was thinking about this show and planning to talk with you, I was thinking about how most people of any political persuasion might be quick to say that many of the problems in our society and in our culture in the U.S. and perhaps around the world, are related to, if not caused directly by, the media. And you have to visualize my air quotes here, the media. You are deeply critical of the existing media environment and structure. Let's talk first about news production. What do you see is wrong with journalism today? And what are you trying to do differently with your online news outlet, whowhatwhy.com?
What I think is wrong with journalism today is what I think has probably always been wrong with journalism. It took me probably two decades to realize that I was part of something that wasn't as good as I thought it was. it just never really was that good. Now, there are a lot of different reasons for that. One is that the ownership structure, most of the media historically has been owned by the wealthy, by people and outfits that were hooked into the corporate world. And that's a problem from the get-go, because if the job of journalism is to get to the truth, that is not the job of corporations. It's to do something else. And so there's the inherent problem.
Well, so do you think that people now who may be critical of the corporate media structure that we have now, is there a lack of understanding of this history of corporate involvement in media?
I think there is. I mean, in the early days, it wasn't so much corporations as it was just wealthy individuals. But still, if you looked at their ecosystems, who their friends were, where their investments were, and so on, they really didn't have any particular stake in exposing injustice per se. And so that was always a clash in the newsroom. I mean, I've seen that myself throughout my career, that the editors want good stuff and they want people to find it bracing and compelling. And at the same time, there's always that line that you're not supposed to cross.
Talk a little bit more about that line you're not supposed to cross.
Yeah, I mean, I remember various people I had worked for, they were always saying, you know, bring me a big story. We want a big story. And I remember bringing one in and somebody saying, that's a little too big. So, you know, there's this sense of that we're all kind of in a I've come to the conclusion it's a kind of a charade that everything is nicer than it actually is, that things work better, that our country is more successful and happier and more egalitarian than it actually is. And, you know, if you think about it, it's not that surprising, really, because journalists are, although they always talk about the liberal media, it's a bit of a myth. Historically, journalists were working class at one time, but they haven't been for a very, very long time. Most of the people working in the big media are people who are very well compensated. They've got good lifestyles and, you know, they've got to pay for their kids' Ivy League education.
Well, so I'm going to read a short paragraph from the conclusion of your book, Family of Secrets. You write, time and again, there has been a rush to bury inquiries into the most perplexing events of our time, along with a determination to subject dissenting views to ridicule. And then you write, and the media were not just enabling these efforts, they were complicit in them, not least by labeling anyone who dared to subject conventional views to a fresh and quizzical eye as a conspiracy theorist. Can you talk a little bit about what you were writing about here?
Sure. Basically, we have a kind of an understanding in the mainstream media, of which I have been a part reluctantly and only partially throughout my career, which is that we just stay away from some subjects. I call them sort of the electrified third rail of journalism. Ironically, or perhaps not ironically, those are the very subjects that people are most interested in, subjects like what really happened on September 11, 2001, such as is it possible that presidents of the United States have been assassinated by anything other than a lone kook? And so there's this kind of consensus that we simply stay away from those things. And if you think about – and this is not just the so-called corporate media. It's even most nonprofit radio, the big entities, the TV, you know who they are. They won't touch any of these things. And privately over a drink, people will often express their concerns or their doubts that about deeper problems in our society. But it's very, very difficult. And we don't even need to be told you can't discuss those things. It doesn't come down to that. We just know.
Well, and is that because the idea of a conspiracy, that there is a vast web of people involved in providing misinformation or perpetuating oppression or perpetuating inequality, is it that that idea of the vast web of the conspiracy is so huge and touches so many people that nobody wants to go there because of what might be revealed about, as you say, people who may even be part of that web themselves?
Well, you know, the term conspiracy is an unfortunate one from the get-go because it creates a kind of a fantastical overlay on what is really just the way that things work. And my interest and the reason I created whowhatwhy.com, our website, and much of the theme in my book Family of Secrets is how we don't get the story about how things actually just work on a day-to-day basis. And that is it's a kind of a conspiracy in the sense that it's people working with other people to do things that they don't want to openly admit to and that the public would be quite upset about if they understood.
We're speaking with Russ Baker this morning on the KUNM Call-In Show. If you have questions for him or comments on news that you would like to see covered and you don't see it being covered in the news outlets that you use, give us a call. 277-5866 is the local number here in Albuquerque. You can also call toll-free 877-899-5866. And we can also take your comments via email. You can send those to callinshow@KUNM.org. Russ, you call the work that you do at whowhatwhy.com forensic journalism. What and how is this different, this forensic journalism, different than what we might hear on NPR or see on CNN or read in the New York Times?
If I may give you a brief example, Who What Why is a nonprofit and we're still fairly new. We're recruiting people with very limited resources, but and some of them are volunteers. But for example, I was talking to someone who was a bureau chief for one of the major news magazines in Washington, and he said he'd be glad to do a story. And I asked him to look into something, and he came back to me almost immediately and said, I have no idea how to do this. The reason was he was so reliant on handout journalism, press release journalism. Much of what you see on the news, I think it's something like 80 or 90% of all the news is generated from press releases. And it's basically people showing up at events, taking quotes from people who have calculated their remarks for a particular effect. So there's almost no initiative involved. There's almost no curiosity or starting from scratch, wondering why something is the way it is and then trying to find out without an agenda. That's really what I want to do. That to me is pure journalism.
Do you think that that we as members of the general public are even we not aware of how kind of constructed news journalism is? I mean, I know there's been coverage of, for example, the packages produced by PR companies for, you know, various corporations that are then sent to TV stations that are then used in local TV news broadcasts as if they were news stories instead of PR packages from that were produced for and by the companies that they are purportedly about. That's one of the examples that I think of off the top of my head, the widespread use of that, those types of products in mainstream, you know, commercial TV news programs. Are we unaware of how much it's happening?
Yes. It's happening also on much more subtle levels. One example was the use by the networks of consultants to explain what was happening in Iraq and Afghanistan. And only later did we learn that these people were perhaps on the payroll of large military contractors. They were retired generals, very much with a stake in what was going on. But it extends to everything. I mean, the way in which we are fed up the presidential election, for example, with a heavy emphasis on certain candidates who are more acceptable. We'll have a new piece up on whowhatwhy.com either probably today at some point about that. I've been taking a look at the New York Times and how they seem to be rallying around Romney and wanting to keep Gingrich out. And you can see it in the kind of very soft, glossy pieces being done about Romney, kind of warming him up a little bit. Now, it's not – I don't know that there was ever any explicit discussion of that, but there's an understanding that the time sensibility is Newt Gingrich is dangerous and Romney is not. And so this is why very often we end up with candidates who are sort of similar. I mean, they're not that – if you take Obama and McCain, they were really very similar in a lot of ways. And this is why our choices end up being so limited.
Is that kind of self-reflexive media criticism work – is that kind of work going to be the kind of thing we're going to see dominating the work on whowhatwhy.com? I noticed some of the stories that are up now are stories that are exactly that, analysis of media coverage of various events.
We do a lot of analysis of media coverage, not because we want to, but because inevitably every story goes there. So, for example, we see things that are being covered and we wonder why we're seeing that story. So, for example, with Libya, there was very much a theme that this was a righteous, justified intervention by NATO, which I didn't have any particular position on. But the more I thought about it and the more I looked at it, the more I thought, I don't think they're giving us the real story. And so invariably then I looked at the media and I could see that, yeah, there was – again, there was no effort to try to figure out what was really going on there.
I want to ask another question about the viability of an online news outlet. We had one here in New Mexico, the New Mexico Independent, for several years, produced some really fine journalism, and the funding dried up for that particular site. Are you concerned that there's not the support for/market for the kind of work that you're doing in an online format?
There is a market for it. One of the strengths of Who, What, Why is that we are nonpartisan and we get tremendously positive feedback. We just did a survey and a very large percentage of the people we sent it to responded and they said, we love your site. A lot of them were, a lot of these independent sites are identified as liberal or conservative or something, but we run the gamut, and it's because they know that we're going in with an open mind and we're trying to look. So I think the future is very, very bright for that. We need to create a culture where people understand that if they don't fund it, somebody else is going to fund it, and they may not get the stories that they want to hear with the kind of integrity behind it.
And how is doing online news shifting? I mean, you've done a lot of print journalism work and writing with your books. How is shifting to online, how does that change the way that your work either is organized or the timeline or what is the difference?
Well,
for you,
paradoxically, things like your show are becoming more important, and so people often won't read something. They want — I'm on the radio quite a lot and they just go and listen to these podcasts or they want to see a little clip of me on some television show. So we need to be multimedia. We need to tell stories in all formats.
So are you imagining expanding into video format and audio format on your website?
We want to do it all. As you pointed out, unfortunately, it does come down to funding to some
extent. It's very expensive work. It's what we say every couple of times a year when we do our pledge drives, is to remind our listeners how expensive public radio reporting is to produce. And then expanding into video and all in an online format can be daunting, I would imagine.
We really keep our costs down and live lean. And if enough members of the public step up, you know, we give them an option to make a monthly donation, or you probably do the same thing at your station, or one time.
We call it the Radio Frequency Club, yeah. where people are, you know, donate on a monthly basis.
Sure. And then occasionally we get somebody who is blessed with substantial resources, who really cares about getting the real story out, and they'll step forward. We want to move into all of those things. We want to be doing video and audio and graphic novels for people who like that kind of comic book style of storytelling. You can still do journalism that way. You can do it in many, many different forms.
Great. Let's take a quick break. We're talking with Russ Baker. He is an award-winning investigative journalist and author of Family of Secrets, about the Bush family's impact on U.S. history and politics. We'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back. We have some callers lined up, and we'll be right back with you.
Support comes from Visit Denver, announcing Denver Mile High Holidays, featuring lighting displays, theater, dance, concerts, and other holiday events scheduled now through January. More information at milehighholidays.com.
Support comes from Saggio's, homemade real Italian pizza, calzones, pasta, salads, and desserts, serving Albuquerque and the UNM community since 1968. Saggio's encourages support of public radio KUNM on Cornell Southeast across from UNM and at saggios.com.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. We're joined today by investigative journalist Russ Baker. If you have a question for him, thoughts on our current media environment, the kinds of news stories that you would like to see covered, or perhaps there's been some coverage of a news story that you really appreciated and thought really got down to the bottom of the barrel as far as information and exposure of what's going on, give us a call. 277-5866 is the local number here in Albuquerque. You can also call toll-free 877-899-5866, or you can shoot us an email to callinshow@kunm.org. Let's take a few of your calls. Jane in Albuquerque, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I just want to say thanks, Russ, for being on the program and having this show. I just want to comment on what you just said about there being a certain tendency, like the unspoken taboo of reporting on conspiracy theories like 9/11. But there has been a tendency in the past to make things seem more organized, like the mob, for instance. And this, I think this kind of contradicts what you just said, but, you know, I'd like your comment on that anyway.
Well, sure. That's an interesting point there. Both of these things happen. In other words, there is an oversimplification of issues that are much more complex and nuanced, and then there is an attempt to avoid identifying actual narratives that exist. So I think both of those things happen. Unfortunately, they both sort of skew in the opposite direction of where they should be going.
Let's take another call. Joan in Taos. Good morning, Joan. You're on the air.
Joanne.
Oh, I apologize. Joanne, welcome.
Yes. I have access to BBC, and the very things that Russ is saying about U.S. media apparently is not only the U.S. They had a considerable piece last night on the withdrawal of American troops from Iraq, but they did not say one word, as is often the case with American media, about oil. Is that one of those taboos that we're not allowed to think about or discuss?
It very much is. In fact, if you go to our website, whowhatwhy.com, you'll see we did quite a few stories about Libya. And the story there, we were told, was that Gaddafi was subjecting his population to all kinds of things. But the reality was that a decision had been made, actually led by France, to go in and get the oil there. And I think we document that pretty conclusively. So, yes, the problem with the BBC is that they are very close with the British government, which also needs that oil. The United States didn't need the oil. The United States went in for other reasons, but Britain, France, Italy, definitely it was the oil. And you're not going to hear that story on any of their national broadcasting outlets.
Well, there was, you know, there's been some coverage over the past couple of days about the drawdown of U.S. forces in Iraq. And again, you were talking about Libya. Is that trend, though, of not talking about Middle Eastern oil. Do you see that as being part of coverage of Iraq also?
Absolutely. It's part of coverage of Afghanistan as well. The Pentagon only recently released the story that, hey, guess what? What a surprise. It turns out there is more than $1 trillion worth of extremely valuable minerals under Afghanistan. The reality is that when you look at the rhetoric and they talk about national security interest in these places, they're talking about oil. They all know that. Every senator knows that. But they can't say that publicly because you can't justify to the international community going into another country to seize its resources. So therefore, there are always these code words being used.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. Where do you get your news? And do you find the stories that you want to see covered well there? Give us a call. 277-5866 is the local number here in Albuquerque. You can also call toll-free 877-899-5866 or send us an email to callinshow@kunm.org. Let's go to Malia in Albuquerque. Good morning, Malia. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks. This is a great show. And it couldn't be more timely. You know, I was listening to an earlier caller, the one about the BBC, and her comment was, it really jogged my memory because I just watched 60 Minutes on Sunday night. Now, this is supposed to be investigative journalism at its finest. One of the interviews they did, actually, was with Warren Buffett's son. Now, Warren Buffett's son does a lot of philanthropic work. He's a middle son. Nobody thought he was going to inherit the empire, but his father has evidently said he's going to. Now, the point here that I'm trying to make is that what he's doing is going to other countries and cooperating with other philanthropic agencies. But what he's actually trying to teach, and they did not even say the words, is sustainable farming. Instead of our brand of agriculture, he's actually working with them, with the resources they have, using their seeds and teaching them actually sustainable agriculture. They showed a small clip of him with some people in a certain area where he was teaching them. But they were, I know they were, it was obvious they completely danced around that whole point, that he was differing with the, for instance, the Gates Foundation, and he actually did go so far as to say, well, we're not using hybrid seeds or chemical fertilizers. And I'm sure that that was as much as they would even allow him to say. So even investigative reporting is edited rather severely. So the reason he's doing so much good over there is because he's teaching them how to use their resources and sustainable agriculture
sure.
to feed their people.
First of all, I'm not sure I call that investigative journalism. I've worked with some of these programs, and they do some good work. But basically what they're doing is they are making a little movie, and they're telling a story that has already usually been researched and reported by somebody else. They're trying to get maximum entertainment value out of that. I suspect that was probably fairly benign. They tragically thought that this issue of sustainable agriculture was not going to be that interesting to a lot of the viewers, and so they kind of minimized that. Also, you have to keep in mind, and this would not be overt, but if you look at the advertisers on the networks, a lot of these giant agricultural companies are always on there, and they're very much opposed to these kinds of things. So I think that would certainly be a factor, at least in the back of some people's minds.
Let's take another call. Clifton in Albuquerque. Good morning, Clifton. You're on the air.
Good morning, Elaine. Another great show, Russ. Wonderful work. My college studies, I've read a couple of books. One of them was called The Whole World is Watching, and the other one was called Deciding What's News. And I don't remember the authors, but they were wonderful examples of how media shaped America's perception of involvement in the Vietnam War, for example. And I'm sure you're familiar with them, Russ, and I was just curious if you had any more contemporary examples of that kind of you know, if there's anything newer, I'd love for people to get a chance to read those books, but those events are so, they're relatively far back in our generational history, and I thought maybe there were some more contemporary examples. Thank you.
We do carry a show here at KUNM, Russ, called Counterspin, which you may be familiar with from the organization Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And they pretty regularly try to identify different angles in coverage by the corporate media that either are not included or heavily dominant in coverage that a certain event receives. What are you working on with respect to media coverage and bias that you've isolated?
Mainly what we're doing is responding to things that are being put out, particularly we pick on the big guys. So the New York Times ran a video where they were interviewing a man about an oddity related to the assassination of John F. Kennedy, a so-called umbrella man, a man who'd stood on the grassy knoll and pumped his umbrella on a sunny day just as Kennedy was being shot. And this this little mini documentary sort of poo-poos it and says it turns out it was just a coincidence. He was trying to send some obscure political message. Well, we have been going after the New York Times because of the fact that they simply won't look into any of these stories, even when there's a preponderance of evidence suggesting that more is going on. So we will take those kind of things. But, you know, the key issue for me is that we here in the United States are the most heavily propagandized people on earth outside of probably North Korea and a handful of other places. The average American is more poorly informed about how things that affect them actually come down than almost anybody anywhere, and I'm including most developing countries. People here really don't have an understanding, and it's partially their fault, but it's also partially the fault of the media for not thinking they could tell the real story, not wanting to do the extra work, not wanting to take on the kind of pressures that you face when you reveal uncomfortable truths.
Do you believe there's a role for media consumers in their response to coverage that they either feel is biased or that they don't like? I mean, in your work for the New York Times or The Nation or the LA Times, I mean, did you get feedback from your readers saying this was wrong? Or is there a two-way communication going on between large media outlets and their consumers?
There was a little bit. Now, fortunately, there is a lot. And this is the great thing about the online world is that everybody out there listening to this program can go online and post comments either to probably your station's site, to our site, whowhatwhy.com. They can go on Twitter. They can go on Facebook. And so it's become much more of a two-way dialogue. And I think even the most powerful news organizations now are compelled to respond very, very quickly.
You know, I'm thinking specifically of a story that was published by the New York Times kind of following up on the gang rape of an adolescent girl in a small town in Texas. And there was critique of this article in the New York Times as kind of presenting a perspective only of the young men who had been accused of this rape and kind of blaming, using some language that has been identified as the kind of language that blames the victim, blaming this young woman for the fact that she had been gang raped. And there was a petition that went around, at least I'm a member of a women in journalism organization, and there was a petition that went around, and I know that people signed on and complained to the New York Times, and the New York Times actually, I think they wrote an editorial with an apology of some sort to address the imbalance in that story and the pattern of blaming the victim that is pretty consistent across many media outlets when it comes to crimes against women, violence against women.
I mean, I think they will do that in certain instances on the really big subjects, which are war and who owns this country and things like that. That's where they're not really going to write an editorial and say, oh, sorry, we've been telling you the wrong story for 10 years.
Let's take another call. John in Santa Fe. Good morning, John. You're on the air.
Good morning, Elena. I'd like to follow up on the code of silence over the issue of whether we and or the Europeans are going into these Middle Eastern countries to get their oil. I wonder if you know or if your guest is aware of any investigative reporting or coverage on the kind of cost-benefit analysis that would go into a decision to go to war and spend billions of dollars potentially prosecuting that war as opposed to just buying the oil. Common sense tells me, I've never done this kind of a study, but common sense tells me maybe it's just a lot cheaper to buy the oil, and so why would we or the French or the British invade a country to get the oil when we could simply buy it on the market, although it may even be at inflated prices. Thank you, and I'll get off and listen to you on the radio.
That is actually a great question, and please feel free, by the way, if you have a question like that, to contact us at whowhatwhy.com. We do like to get input from our audience, and we do follow up a lot of these things. I'd love to do that analysis. I can tell you this, though. The calculation is a little bit more complex because when you go to war, that funds your economy, particularly one of the things that fascinates me is how we never talk about this giant military contracting part of our economy. Those companies, if you read their annual reports, whenever there's a war, they talk about how good business is, and they need that business. And so all of these wars, and you know, Obama has just added wars, but there are wars there now. There isn't much reporting on this. They're going into sub-Saharan Africa, actually, purportedly to go after one of these horrendous cult armies there. But that doesn't seem to be the real reason. It's, again, resources. So I don't think it's a straight calculation. But also my guess, by the way, is it is actually still much cheaper. Libya, for example, has enormous reserves. Iraq has enormous reserves. And you can bet that that calculation was certainly made. Although I do agree with you that it's not being made of whether this is a good financial deal for the average taxpayer.
Yeah, talking about whose interest is being calculated.
Right.
We've got an email here from Tony. And he writes that it seems like the healthiest publications and most financially successful websites today are focused on business. Bloomberg, Smart Money, The Wall Street Journal. He writes most of the reporting there reads like sports reporting to him, carefully worded to protect the reporter's access to sources. And he asks you, Russ, what's your take on U.S. business journalism?
It's terrible. And it's totally boosterism. I agree entirely with your analysis. My concern is that business journalism has always been writing for the business people. Yet what companies do affect all of us. And what we would like to do at Who, What, Why on our menu of ambitions is to create a business department, a sports department, an entertainment department, but not to do this fluffy stuff, but to really go in and figure out what is actually going on and not to be reliant on handouts or sources from the top levels of those companies. What you want is you want whistleblowers or you want your own initiative where you go digging in from the outside.
Let's take another call. John in Albuquerque. Good morning, John. You're on the air.
Good morning. This is an excellent show, and I hope we do more of these. Being as journalism is the fifth estate, I have been depressed for probably 25 years about the state of journalism. I remember in the 60s and 70s, and at least in American journalism, there was a lot of in-depth, investigative journalism that was very fact-based and objective, relatively speaking. I mean, I guess Ronald Reagan, beginning in that era, they created this idea of the liberal media, which I think is a myth. And we lost the media completely from my perspective. You couldn't find true journalism. And now, with what you're talking about and what I've seen on Al Jazeera, I think that Al Jazeera is the most amazing thing in terms of reclaiming the fifth estate, the media, because what they're doing, they have the best journalists all over the world, locally based, who want to work for them, and they provide the most objective journalism that I've seen. I was just amazed because I thought they were very pro-Arab, pro-Muslim, you know, when the Iraq war started and everything, there was a lot of talk about Al Jazeera.
I understand why you think Al Jazeera is terrific, but I have some bad news for you rendered on our website, whowhatwhy.com, where you can read about our disappointment when we look carefully at Al Jazeera. There are, as you point out, many fine people working there who want to do the story.
Well, there's many fine people working everywhere.
Everywhere. Every news organization, most of the people are fine.
You'd be hard-pressed to find a news organization that doesn't have really good, not necessarily objective, but people who are aware of their own biases and who are reporting outside of and around those.
And this is true of every institution, including the U.S. military and the Central Intelligence Agency. They're full of decent, good people. The problem is not the individuals, but the corporate direction. And that's the same thing with Al Jazeera. It's run by and funded by the Emir of Qatar, who has very much an agenda, which is to stay in power and to have good relationships with the Saudis and so forth. And they totally pulled their punches on a whole bunch bunch of things. We just did an article on our site about an uprising in Saudi Arabia that has not been covered at all. Al Jazeera, tiny bit, but barely. On Libya, they also went along with this fake story as to why NATO went in there. So unfortunately, even the better ones like Al Jazeera are not really all that good.
But would you say that Al Jazeera, as this caller pointed out, does have a significant amount of good, well-reported stories in the type of – in this traditional journalistic format that we're talking about, where we're reporting on facts and not driven by the agenda of somebody else?
I think they have more people physically on the street. So, for example, in Egypt during the uprising and so forth, who are natives of the region and speak the language, and that's a good thing. But I think that still at the higher levels of that organization, these things are being massaged.
Let's take another call. Matt in Los Lunas. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for this very interesting program. I just wanted to ask, well, I wanted to say first that the whole idea of the corporate dominance of our media is, I don't know, maybe we're too far gone down that line now that they've been granted personhood by the Supreme Court last year. I don't know if we're going to be able to turn that around, but your guest alluded to the fact of pressure being brought to bear when you maybe get a little too close to the truth or push a little too hard to find the truth. And I'm just wondering if you could expand on that idea of what type of pressure is brought to bear. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I mean, throughout my career, I found that when I had a really, really big story that was really going to make waves, they were excited to do it, and then they were afraid. And so, you know, it's one of the things I say in my book, Family of Secrets, is that I concluded in the 5 years I spent researching that the biggest way of oppressing people is to have them oppress themselves, the fear in their own minds. And I see this constantly in this country, and it's very, very prevalent in the media right up to the highest levels, that people can be pushed out or replaced, and there are always other people waiting to get those jobs. So I think this is a huge issue, and I think this is why if we do fund independent outlets where there is no key figure or financial structure bearing down on it, then we can get much, much better quality information.
We're talking with Russ Baker. He is an award-winning investigative journalist and author of the book Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. We're going to take a quick break. If you'd like to participate in the conversation, you have a question for Russ or a comment on the state of journalism and the media today, you can call locally here in Albuquerque, 277-5866. You can also call toll-free 877-899-5866 or shoot us an email to callinshow@kunm.org. We'll be right back.
Cherish the Ladies comes to Popejoy Hall with its holiday show, An Irish Homecoming. Joined by Maura O'Connell, six champion step dancers, and more, Cherish the Ladies brings us a Christmas celebration fashioned with care and filled with the cheery goodwill of the season. It's like Christmas around the hearth with the whole family near. An Irish Homecoming in Popejoy Hall, Sunday, December 18th. Get tickets and information at popejoypresents.com. A message from the tax-exempt Popejoy Hall.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. It's 8:42. I'm Elaine Baumgartel, and Russ Baker has joined me in the studio today to talk about the state of journalism today. And in a little bit, we'll get to his book, Family of Secrets. But I'd like to take a few more calls. Gordon in Sandia Park. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Elaine and Russ. Thank you for taking my call. I had a comment. I really enjoy KUNM, particularly the Counterspin, Alternative Radio, and Democracy Now! However, the NPR news has been really disappointing, particularly on the topics such as the Gulf oil spill, that they took a scientist that was funded by BP and failed to and saying that the Gulf oil spill was all taken care of, the bacteria was going to eat it, and if you eat it and take care of it, and it's really quite a problem down there, and I was really disappointed that NPR would do that. And also with the nuclear industry, I find that they are really prejudiced towards the corporate power in the nuclear industry. You don't ever hardly get anyone that would give a good, strong counter argument, such as Omri, Lovins, et cetera. And so that's my particular thought.
Sure,
I'd be interested in Russ and your comments.
Thank you. I mean, I think that the problem NPR faces is they're always under severe pressure. There is a very well-oiled machine funded mostly by corporate interests and very wealthy people who put constant pressure on these entities that do try to do a good job. The problem NPR has is because of the funding that it gets from the government, even though that's a fairly small share of it, it definitely keeps its thumb on them. And I mean, that's one of the reasons that I started whowhatwhy.com, our nonprofit, nonpartisan investigative reporting site. We would eventually love to have a radio component and so forth, because what we're trying to do is to be completely unencumbered. And unencumbered by everybody, and that means everybody. And so we get people who are mad at us, even from the other side. They think we don't go far enough because we don't satisfy whatever their preconceived notions is of how a story ought to come out. And we say, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to go in with an open mind. We're going to try to figure out what happened, and we're just going to tell it straight.
Let's take another call. Sarah in Albuquerque. Good morning, Sarah. You're on the air.
Thank you. This has all been very interesting, because I sort of thought that Al Jazeera was a pretty good outlet myself. I like to think of myself as a contrarian. Where, Russ, do you get your news? How can we make decisions about this that are intelligent? We're not news people, the rest of the public. How do we know who's telling the truth and who's slanting it?
Well, you don't really know. I mean, one of the ways you can know is if a particular individual or an outlet repeatedly checks for you. In other words, they repeatedly come through, and what they say turns out to be true. You can start trusting that brand. But I have to tell you, if I knew of a lot of good news sources, I would never have gone out on a limb and started a whole new news organization, which is what I did with whowhatwhy.com. And that is because I just don't see it out there. And I have to say, it's the same thing with the so-called alternative media. I've written for the mainstream outfits and the so-called alternative, and I've had frustration with all of them. The mainstream, because they're very, very hesitant to offend the establishment institution, and the so-called alternative institutions, because they are working, they are preaching to a choir, they have preconceived notions. If you come into those same outlets that I worked for, these you want to call them liberal, progressive magazines, with a story that cuts in a different direction, they won't publish it. So there really are, unfortunately, very, very few good outlets out there. There are some, and I think, believe it or not, things like Twitter are very useful. If you see that people are excited about things, that's a probably better recommendation than just the fact that something's been around for a long time.
Well, so, Russ, I want to ask you about this idea of, having a broad range of outlets, none of which are providing multiple perspectives on multiple stories from really in-depth levels. How is this related to media research that shows that people go to news outlets that provide them information that reinforces what they already know, that ascribes to the same perhaps cultural values or political views that they have, that people go to what is going to make the most sense to them, and it was what is going to validate their point of view most strongly, as opposed to going to sources that are going to challenge them or be contrary?
That's very, very true, Elaine. In fact, one of the things that we are trying to do with whowhatwhy.com is to specifically target people who are open-minded or who want to try to open their minds. Because if you go to a lot of the sites, you can see people are definitely they've got their minds made up. So that's a big part of it. Another part of it is that people want to be entertained. They have increasingly short attention spans. And even though people complain about the prurient material and the trashy material, they love it, because that's if you look at big sites like Huffington Post and look at the number of comments on serious stories not written by celebrities compared to ones written by celebrities or ones that have a sexual or other element, and suddenly the number of comments just explodes.
Let's take another call. Felipe in Albuquerque. Good morning, Felipe. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks, and this is a great conversation. I just want to talk about a little bit about new media, and sort of what concerns me is that, you know, stories, pretty much the blogosphere, people just take stories that are from the mainstream media, like a New York Times or an LA Times, and they just rehash it and just, like, slaughter it to death and just, like, sort of analyze it, but they don't really provide any sort of new news. And there's really only a couple of sites, like I say ProPublica, which is pretty new, that go and do in-depth investigation, which so my question is, what do you see as the future of new media, and how do you think it'll play a role in investigative journalism?
We don't know yet. I mean, my favorite thing to do throughout my career has been stories that take a really long time. My book, Family of Secrets, more than 500 sources in there. There are stories on our site, whowhatwhy.com, where you can see that we took months to do these things. Now, how do you do that when you have almost no budget? It's very, very difficult. And even these big outlets, they don't want to do it because it's much cheaper for them to do what you were talking about, which is to aggregate stories from elsewhere to put up. By the way, if you take the aggregation and you add in the entertainment stuff and then you add in the opinion stuff and you add in the so-called breaking news stuff, which really doesn't involve much reporting at all, you're up to probably 99% of all of the content. And our commitment at whowhatwhy.com is to try to do that 1%. How can we get the public more of that 1%?
Let's take another call. Irene in Santa Fe. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm now interested in how will the universities deal with this new approach to news and journalism, and that we can wind up with a new breed of journalists that might be, well, functioning the way you are. And I wish you great good luck with your new endeavor. But what will happen there in terms of younger people who have the passion to want to be journalists?
This was something that I was interested in also. I've taught a bit at the University of New Mexico in the journalism department. And you know, young up-and-coming journalists have a completely different atmosphere in which they are entering the field, where they're being asked to do things like blog, video, write, record, produce, you know, do all of the kind of multimedia aspect of the work, which doesn't leave a lot of time for the investigative part.
Exactly. And speaking as a person who was a former member of a faculty at a journalism school as an adjunct and a graduate of one of those schools, I think, unfortunately, they're not really up to this task that we are focusing on. They are now trying to teach people how to survive in an environment where there's very little money. You know, they want you, you know, how to use your own camera, how to put up your own website. And so they're giving them technical tools.
Work for free for a while,
right,
so we can see if we like
That's
what you
right.
do.
But ultimately, it's still feeding into the corporate world, which is really what universities are about. Anybody who thinks that universities are primarily about teaching people to think for themselves or question authority better take a hard look again at who funds those universities. They're about creating a compliant corporate employees to a large extent. I still love universities and education, and there's this struggle going on inside of them at every university. But I think this is a problem. And one of the reasons we started WhoWhatWhy.com is to do exactly what you've just said, which is to train a whole new generation of journalists. We want to do that. If we have just even a modicum of funding, we're going to be able to give small stipends to them and pair them up with veteran journalists who themselves got fed up with the system and want to teach these people how to do it the right way.
Well, and so in a way, that's kind of what you've done with your books is I'm fed up with this system and I'm going to go out on my own and produce reporting in very in-depth fashion. This is a pretty thick book. What is it? 500 pages long. We have a call about the Bush family. Let's take that call and then we'll start talking about your book. Bill in Los Lunas. Good morning, Bill. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Two quick comments. My first comment is that one of my pet peeves about investigative reporters or any journalist is when they have, regardless of the story, have comments on the story about, well, according to company officials or according to federal officials, they said this, they say that. That means to me that they're not doing their footwork and doing their job properly. Now, I assume that today's story show on the call-in show was about the Bush family, and nothing has been said anything at all about the Bush family. and we're already at the end of the hour. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. So your book, Russ, Family of Secrets, you discuss Bush family involvement or relationships with some of the major political events of the 20th century, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, the Watergate scandal that was the downfall of President Richard Nixon. So talk to us about what you would say the overarching impact has been of the Bush family in a minute. No, I'm just kidding.
Okay. We've got a couple I'll do this fast. This will be my elevator speech. Basically, I spent 5 years on this. I wondered why somebody as improbable as George W. Bush became president of the United States and then plunged this country and the world into so many controversies. I had no answer to that at all. In the course of the 5 years, I came upon information that was so shocking to me that it really changed my understanding, not just of his presidency, but of much of the last 50 or even 100 years of American history. I discovered stunning surprise after surprise on so many levels. In a nutshell, here's what it is. I like to have more time to do this because the material is so shocking that people kind of – it's some cold water in their face. But basically, the key to the story of George W. Bush is his father. And the key to his father is that he was CIA director. And my discovery was that he was not only CIA director for a year, as we know he was, but he actually was covertly involved with intelligence operations for almost his entire adult life undercover. This is all documented. We've got about 60 pages of footnotes in Family of Secrets. Basically, what I learned was that there was a whole back history to the shaping of the father's presidency, the son's presidency, and then this constant behind-the-scenes power struggle going on between entities like the so-called national security state on the one hand, and on the other hand, these civilian elected officials who have much, much less power than we understand. Family of Secrets takes us back through the Bush family, three, four, five generations, as they are serving very much as enablers of the agenda of the 1%. You see them working with some of the wealthiest families in America all the way back at the beginning of the 19th century. And so this is very, very important. And then we see that president after president after president, when they got into office, they were surprised to find out how little power they had, and they began struggling. And I think this epitomizes presidencies, including Eisenhower, Truman, Kennedy, and I think that what happened to Kennedy, and I have four chapters of new material in Family of Secrets on the Kennedy assassination, something I knew nothing about before I began writing the book, but I learned that George H.W. Bush had claimed he couldn't remember where he was on November 22.
Which is so unusual because so many people who were alive and who weren't tiny children when that happened.
Sure.
Have such very clear memories
right.
of where they were and what was happening when they found
and
out.
And I just wanted to know where he was. And so this took me back into his covert CIA activities in 1963, his presence in Dallas, his association with a number of individuals involved in military intelligence who got into the lead car of the motorcade. We could go on and on.
And then
I move it forward to Watergate, where we find George H.W. Bush again in the catbird seat, this time as Nixon is being brought down by a scandal that I learned was not what I thought it was, that it was not Nixon behind Watergate. It was people further to the right than him who wanted him out.
So if you'd like to hear more about Family of Secrets, Russ is speaking tonight at 7 p.m. in Albuquerque at the New Mexico Federation of Labor. There's a link to Russ Baker's website online on our website, KUNM.org. He's an award-winning journalist and author. And thanks so much for joining us this morning, Russ.
Thank you very
Appreciate
much.
Appreciate your time. You can email us your comments or tips for show topics to callinshow@kunm.org. To listen to this or previous KUNM call-in shows online, you can visit our website, kunm.org. We're taking a holiday break here at the call-in show. We'll be back on January 5th with a conversation about how to keep up those New Year's resolutions. For the next 2 weeks at 8 o'clock on Thursday morning, we'll bring you the best of the best of the 2011 Third Coast International Audio Festival broadcasts from WBEZ in Chicago and PRX, the best documentary pieces from radio pros and up-and-comers from around the world. We'll have part one for you next week on Thursday at 8 o'clock, followed by part two on Thursday, December 29th at 8 a.m. This is the KUNM Call-In Show. We'll be back on January 5th. Engineering this morning was done by Roman Garcia. Call screening by Michael Hess. Our news intern is Andy Lyman. I'm Elaine Baumgartel, and this is KUNM.